It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. As concern surrounding the threat of climate change grows, there's been a growing interest in a shift to renewable energy infrastructure. Here are some statistics. According to the U.S. Energy Information Association, renewable energy accounted for 10% of the power created in Wisconsin in 2020. Most of the renewable energy comes from hydropower and windmills, with less than 0.5% coming from utility and small-scale solar combined. That said, the majority of energy in the state produced last year was still generated from coal, natural gas, and nuclear energy. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about renewable energy infrastructure? Are you hopeful we'll be able to find enough to wean off of fossil fuels, build enough of that infrastructure? And do you have solar panels on your home or business? And how can renewable energy be made more accessible? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Greg Nemeth. He is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and international environmental policy. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, good morning. It's good to be here.
So there are right now a few different strategies being used to transition to renewable energy sources. Can you break those down for us?
Well, what we're seeing are, you know, we had been seeing policy driving renewables. So we had in our state, 10% of electricity had to be met by renewables in 2015. That was set in 2005, and we met that. But since then, we've been stalled at around, as you said, around the same level, around 10%. But in the meantime, we've had much more private sector activity just wanting to build new renewables because they're inexpensive, because customers are starting to demand them, and also because there's some anticipation that in the longer term, maybe not that long, maybe a few years, we're going to need to have way less fossil fuel emissions, and renewables are a good solution to that. So it's really been driven by multiple factors lately. And so I think what we're starting to see is a second resurgence in our state to kind of catch up with the rest of the country and what's happening in the rest of the world.
Now, let's look at Wisconsin specifically. What does Wisconsin's energy grid look like overall?
Yeah, I think traditionally, and this was just a few years ago, you could have said most, like literally most, more than half of our electricity was coming from coal. And that's not true anymore. We've really started to shut down coal plants in the last several years. Surprisingly to many, because some of these plants were not that old. Some were built in the 1980s, which could have still had more years to run, but they're too expensive to run compared to the alternatives, compared to running natural gas fired power plants or running wind or building wind and solar. And so that's been a big change in Wisconsin. And it's probably surprised most people that we're really switching away from coal and having more renewables and more natural gas. So that's been the big shift.
Now, our neighbor to the west, Minnesota, has taken advantage of a lot of the medium scale community solar. First, can you break down what community solar is versus, you know, smaller scale operations?
Yeah. So you can think about small scale is that's a rooftop solar installation. And that's pretty clear. And then what we've had in the last 5 or 10 years around the country and in a couple places in our state are large scale solar, where it approximates the size of a traditional coal or gas power plant. So those are really large fields or solar farms, sometimes called. Then there's this real sweet spot in between, which is called community solar. And there we might have the equivalent of 200 people's roofs together in one spot. And you might have it in a brownfield, on top of a warehouse, on the side of an airport, those types of places. And they're not massive where it dominates the whole landscape, but they do take advantage of one of the key assets of large-scale solar, which is inexpensive. So there's some economies of scale and some costs that are spread when you do these larger facilities. And community-scale solar, say like 200 times one rooftop, works pretty well with that. And then you can get people to subscribe and get some of their or all of their electricity from one of those community installations. And Minnesota has gone big on that in the last decade. And we're just starting to, and now there's a docket at the PSC on that as well. And that could really open up some possibilities for people to attain solar that can't do it because they have shaded roofs or live in apartments or things like that. So I think that's what's really shown to work pretty well in Minnesota. And I think that'll work pretty well here in Wisconsin as well.
So I just cited some statistics from the U.S. Energy Information Association that said that 0.5% of solar power, that makes up 0.5% of the 10% of renewable energy in Wisconsin. Why are we so behind on solar in particular?
Yeah, so we're behind other places, partly because we have less sunshine. That's pretty obvious. But just to be clear, it's about a factor of two difference between the sunniest places in the U.S., so Arizona and Southern California in here. So, you know, that means the same solar panel is going to generate half as much electricity. And if you're going to put that into dollar terms, like what our electricity bill will look like, that same installation will be twice as expensive in Wisconsin as it is in other places. So you would expect it to be less, but we shouldn't be that much less than, say, our neighbors with a similar solar resource like Minnesota. And so we have been behind on that. But it really does seem like we're starting to catch up. If you look at, you know, there's a regional organization that manages a transmission. And if you're going to build a new large power plant, you have to file with them to make sure that there's an adequate transmission and it's sited in the right place. And the last time I looked at that, there were 30 large solar farms plan to go in Wisconsin. Maybe not all of those will happen, but some will be added that aren't there now. And, you know, that would really transform from the two we have today to something like 30. So we're behind, and that 0.5% you mentioned, you know, represents where we are. And, you know, the whole world is at 3% solar. So we're behind the rest of the world, not just our neighbors to the west. But, you know, the key thing to think about is these numbers here are growing quickly. And so if you're growing, as solar has been overall for the last 30 years, at 30% a year, that means every about 3 years, we're doubling the amount of solar. And so that 0.5% could get up to something much more substantial, you know, if we just grow at the rate that the rest of the world is growing. So I think we're actually likely to see quite a bit more solar in our state in the near future.
We're talking to Greg Nemet right now, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and international environmental policy. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Lily in Dodgeville. Hi, Lily.
Hi, good morning. Under this Wisconsin State Statute 196.3784GE, the Wind Siting Council is supposed to meet every 5 years and send a report to the chief clerk of each house of the legislature. However, there has been no meeting or report since 2014. The PSC 128 is out of date. It doesn't cover the large-scale green energy projects. It only covers small-scale. While there is a large scale wind project currently trying to gain ground here in Iowa and Lafayette counties, which will have 3.5 megawatt wind turbines that are 695 feet tall. While Wisconsin farms are being overrun by large scale green energy utility projects, the Wind Siting Council is AWOL. As Greg is on the Wind Siting Council, why has the council not met since 2014?
Thank you, Lily, for that call. Your response, Greg?
Yeah, you're right. I'm on the council. I was joined last year. We haven't met. I'm not sure when we will meet. I would love to meet and discuss these issues with the rest of the council, because the siting is such a crucial issue. And it's been true all along of things like pipelines and power lines and coal power plants and gas power plants and renewables in the same way, for different reasons, but the aesthetics, the impacts on landscapes are crucial. And those are things we need to work out. And I'm very much a big advocate of, you know, deliberative processes here, of having public comment and thinking through the pros and cons. And so I would very much welcome more, you know, public engagement and also that council being active in how things are cited. And I agree. I think, you know, part of the reason to your previous question is why we have so little solar and wind is because we haven't had a really active, helpful, healthy process of public deliberation about siting. And I think that's probably why we have less than other places have. Because my thinking is that you can cite things well and you can cite things badly. It's not just yes or no. And so doing things like citing solar plants behind hedgerows and behind rows of trees, a little bit out of sight, similar with wind farms. There's things that you can do that, you know, don't make them invisible, but make them much more fitting with this, you know, gorgeous, beautiful landscapes that we have in our state. And I very much hope we can do more with that.
Thank you for that call, Lily. Now, Greg, this is not the switch to renewables is not just a Wisconsin issue. It's something that is being considered at the national level. Lawmakers in D.C. have reached a deal on an infrastructure package. The bill hasn't passed yet, and it certainly has been signed into law. But that proposal includes $73 billion for new power lines. What is the goal in these lines, and how much renewables are going to be part of this?
Yeah, so one enables the other. So transmission power lines allows for more renewables. And, you know, as we get from 10% renewables like we have in our state and what the world has to levels that are much higher like other countries have, there's countries that produce more than 100% of their electricity from renewables and have to export some of it. And as you start to get to more and more renewables, you start to say, oh, it's not just about siting or just about policy and incentives. It's how do you manage a power grid where the power is not on and off when you want it, but it's on and off when the wind wants to blow or the sun wants to shine. And so there's several different things you can do to make a grid handle large numbers of renewables, like maybe 80 or 90% renewables. You know, you have different renewables. You can have solar and wind. That's one. You can have demand response, like yesterday I allowed MG&E to turn up my thermostat so there wasn't air conditioning because they needed extra power in the afternoon. So that can help quite a bit. You can have storage like batteries or other types of storage around the system to have energy available when it's needed, not just when it's produced, and information technology throughout. But the main thing that can make high amounts of renewables possible is connecting renewables to each other, connecting supply of wind and solar to where the demand is, because that happens in different places and different over different times. And so the more you can move electricity around, the more flexibility there is. And so that's a big motivation for why we would have $70 or $80 billion going into building new transmission, is it to enable much more renewables. If renewables are a big part of how we get to zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. So that it really fits together with more renewables needs more transmission.
We're talking to Greg Nemeth right now. He's a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and more. And he's with us to talk about the future of renewable energy. And in just a minute, we'll talk about large-scale versus regional grids. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about renewable energy, from growing interest in alternative energy to apprehension about the switch to renewables. And we're taking your calls. Are there solar and wind farms in your area? What can you share about that experience? Do you support building large transmission lines to get energy from renewable sources to urban areas? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Greg Nemeth stays with us. He's a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and specializes in energy policy, among many other things. Now, Greg, one of the other things that we've been seeing a lot of right now are issues with grids. And there's been some pushback to this idea of a grid development authority. Why do some folks favor smaller regional energy systems versus larger scale projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really like two kind of models of how the energy system should work that have kind of been in place since like Thomas Edison more than 120 years ago. And, you know, one idea is bigger is better. So centralized generation, more connectivity. It's all one big system that can work together. We've shown we can do that in the past. And that's how you get lots of diverse demand together and lots of diverse supply sources like wind and renewables together. And that's one model of thinking. And then the other model, I would go back to a book I read back in school called Small is Beautiful. This idea that small scale is more human scale. You can have it designed exactly for the way people produce it. You give people autonomy. They can produce their own power, not just be purchasers of it. If you give them, say, solar panels and then a battery in their basement or garage, then they can even start to market power and sell it when it's valuable and save it when they actually need it. So, you know, on one hand, there's kind of more like the physics and the system that where big tends to work better. And then there's the other hand, there's the small scale where autonomy, being able to kind of be your own boss about how you make and use energy has some appeal. And that has some appeal at a few different levels. There's the household level that I just described. You can also think about businesses or schools kind of producing their own power. Then you might have communities that have can work with microgrids where you'd have maybe like a block that kind of has their own mini power system. And then you've got, you know, states like Texas as an example where they created their own electric grid that has very few connections to the outside for similar reasons of autonomy. And so there's a few different models out there. And it's interesting to me how they can actually kind of work together. And if you get it right, you get some of the benefits of the small combined with the benefits of the large at the same time.
Now, you just referenced Texas, and we saw how their energy grid fared this winter. Is there some, in part because it almost entirely went down, are we concerned a little bit about that sort of autonomous grid being an issue for other areas?
Well, I would if there were examples of it. Texas is an extreme example. Like, they've really, you know, they're not an island, but they act as if they are. Like, they've designed their grid and their regulatory authority as if they are. They have their own transmission authority, and it's not connected to the outside except for a few links. And so when something, so in a lot of ways, they have plenty of energy. They have tons of wind power, tons of natural gas. And so they're almost never going to have a problem where they don't have enough energy. And that's been a reason why they wanted to just have their own system all on their own. But, you know, once in a while you have an extreme event, and that's what happened last February when you had this extended cold period. And, you know, it wasn't that cold compared to what we experience, and our, you know, electric grid and natural gas system and power plants are just fine when it's minus 20, below outside. But Texas has not been designed that well that way. They've been designed to operate, with just, you know, once in a while, a few cold places. But this was cold for a week, and it was much colder than they're used to. And so they had gas lines not operating anymore, losing pressure, power plants that couldn't operate of various kinds, especially natural gas power plants, but also their nuclear plants had to stop for a little bit, and some of their wind power was less productive. And so, it all came together at one period. And that's the kind of thing where bigger is better, because when you're linked to the outside, you can start importing power or natural gas when you need it. And so in our state, we're much more connected to the rest of the country, the rest of the Midwest. And so we're in a better situation because of that. And so I think, yeah, we would not have those situations. Plus, we're used to dealing with, you know, really cold weather. So it's not a problem. But, you know, with a changing climate, we could have other situations that we're not used to, maybe really extended and intense hot weather or dry or really excessively wet periods. And those are likely to be more common as we have more extremes in our weather.
We're talking to Greg Nemeth right now, a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Alan in Dodgeville. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. How ironic that this morning's program, the previous program, had to do with how the wealthy got rich. The present system that we have for planning, whether that's at the state level, it was mentioned about wind siting. There's no solar siting. But when you look into the componentries of who sits on those panels, it's all based against small people. It's for only the rich to take advantage of these systems. For example, in Iowa County, if you want to build a doghouse, a proverbial doghouse, you've got to go through zoning with the local officials back and forth. It takes months and months. But if you want to put up an industrial-sized solar a farm that is 10,000 acres, which we do have by Cobb, the local people have no voice in that. If you want to put up a 700, 800-foot tall windmill and place them all around your property, you have no voice against that.
Alan, thank you so much for that call. You know, Greg, we only have about a minute left. What's your response to the community having a say in some of these farms that are built?
Yeah, you know, I think what it all comes down to, really, almost all of it comes down to the Public Service Commission. That is this state regulatory agency that not many people think about. And it's, you know, that is where a lot of these decisions get made, both systemic ones about what the process is when you have to or when you want to install something new, but also on case-by-case basis, like if there's a new power line. So, you know, that's the place where there should be more public comment. And I wish more people would pay attention to the cases that are happening there. You know, there's this new issue on community solar being raised there. I would very much encourage Caller and others to take a look at that and maybe attend the meetings and get engaged, because that's exactly where we need to put some of these voices.
Greg, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Greg Nemeth is a professor in the LaFollette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about renewable energy. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.